This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees at 7:33. Lawmakers and officials met in Morgantown yesterday to announce new rules governing coal dust in an effort to make miners safer, both underground and on surface mines. As Glynis Board reports, it's the first time coal dust levels have been lowered since 1973.
Black lung, or coal workers' pneumoconiosis, is a horrible disease that kills you slowly. Unfortunately, Gary Harrison is one of those suffering. Harrison was among the speakers at the ruling announcement at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health building in Morgantown. He joined with officials from NIOSH, the Department of Labor, and the Mine Safety and Health Administration in announcing new rules that are designed to tighten coal dust regulations. He found out he had black lung in his mid-40s after mining coal for 20 years.
My dad is 88 years old this year. He got black lung. But yet, he walked through the house. And I know he need oxygen, but he still ain't using it. I thought I may be able to do the same thing, but seem like mine may be a little more progressive than what his is.
Miners breathe in coal and, worse, silica dust, which is especially damaging and more prevalent in the thinner seams of coal that are more frequently mined these days. That dust isn't expelled from the lungs. It accumulates and slowly continues to cut, scar, and harden the lungs, making each breath excruciating and increasingly difficult. The disease has claimed the lives of 76,000 miners, which U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas Perez pointed out is 5 miners each day for at least 40 years. And in recent years, the number of younger miners affected has risen significantly. Autopsies performed on the 29 miners killed in the 2010 blast at the Upper Big Branch mine revealed that most of those men had black lung disease, including 5 miners who had worked less than 10 years and 1 miner who was only 25 years old.
A lot of coal companies just ignore the law, ignore safety, ignore common sense, ignore humanity, and ignore their miners. If you're in business and your people are dying from black lung, maybe you shouldn't be in business. Maybe you just shouldn't be in business.
Those were some of the thoughts of West Virginia's retiring Senator Jay Rockefeller. New rules aim to lower exposure to coal dust by closing regulation loopholes, improving testing techniques, and increasing frequency of testing. Maximum dust level permissible in mines will be reduced for the first time in over 40 years from 2 milligrams to 1.5 milligrams. The new rules also aim to increase accountability. Top mine officials will now be required to personally sign off on new dust regulation measures. And medical surveillance tools are also being expanded to surface miners.
But I think we are making history here, but we have to come through now with your help. It's one thing to make an announcement. It's another thing to actually make it happen.
We're taking a common sense approach to implementation, including a step-by-step phase-in that systematically improves protections for miners, that allows time for operators to secure the needed devices and to invest and implement better dust controls.
Assistant Secretary for the Mine Safety and Health Administration, Joe Main, explained that those and several other new regulations are expected to be implemented by 2016. Improved sampling measures are to be in effect by August 1st of this year. New, continuous, real-time dust sampling devices are expected to be implemented by February 1st of 2016. And the lower dust threshold standard changes effective August 1st, 2016. Officials report that technical assistance and information are immediately available. Labor and industry stakeholders are being briefed, and meetings with mine operators and miners to discuss the new regulations are scheduled. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Senator Jay Rockefeller held a forum in Buchanan this week focused on his career in public policy. The forum, open to students and the public alike, was also a way for the senator to encourage young people to get involved in their communities, not just through politics, but through any way they know how. Ashton Mara reports.
In a packed auditorium on the campus of West Virginia Wesleyan College in Buchanan, Senator Jay Rockefeller took a seat on the stage, joined by Emmy Award-winning journalist Ted Koppel, a longtime correspondent for ABC News and former host of their late-night news magazine, Nightline.
We are a pretty amazing pair.
I know. I know.
Isn't that extraordinary?
Wow. I have no Emmys.
I have, well... I have no committees.
I have one Sharon, but no Emmys.
Yeah.
The two sat down as old friends to discuss Rockefeller's decades in politics, his feelings toward the current atmosphere in Washington, and most importantly to him, to motivate young people on the campus of Wesleyan to get involved in public service.
Please get into public service in some form, okay? And then say that's teaching, that's being a nurse, that's being an EMT, that's... firefighter, everything. It's not just called an elected political office. It's called serving your community in some way. You'll never regret it.
Koppel asked the senator to recount the events of his youth that made him feel so strongly about and made him commit himself to public service. Rockefeller told stories of wanting to avoid the reputation of money that came with the family name, of journeying to Japan in college to learn the language and spend time with the people, and then of joining the Peace Corps in the Philippines to help the world. But it was West Virginia, he said, that truly changed him.
Everything in my life has been really kind of rational, except if you look at it closely. I didn't want to live in New York City. I didn't want to be a financier. I wanted to be involved with people as I was in Japan, as I was in the Philippines, but I wanted them to be here in the United States.
Rockefeller moved to Emmons, West Virginia, a poverty-stricken community in Kanawha County, in the early 1960s as a VISTA volunteer.
Which completely changed me. Because there, in 156 families, I think there was one person had a job. Nobody had health care. Nobody had anything. There was a... They didn't even send a school bus out there to pick up the junior high or the high school kids because they said it's just too far away. And so it was sort of Emmons against the world. And it occurred in me a kind of an anger and a rage because I really liked those kids. I liked those parents. And yet they were being shunted aside by the system.
It was that experience that inspired Rockefeller to commit his life to public service. After serving a term in the House of Delegates, then as West Virginia's Secretary of State, Rockefeller lost his first bid for governor. Shortly after, he was named president of Wesleyan College, a position he held for 2 years. Rockefeller says during that time, he contemplated not returning to politics and committing himself to higher education for the remainder of his career.
That, in turn, caused me to do the most profound thinking about where I could do the most good. And it was close, but I opted for the public policy and all the junk that goes along with it.
That junk, he says, are things like campaigning and media appearances, things he admits he doesn't necessarily enjoy.
I have made a practice in my public life of not really caring about whether I appear on television or not, or whether I appear in the newspapers or not. You will very rarely see me on any Sunday shows. Ted never invited me onto his show.
You're too tall.
I was too tall, yeah. But I think that's an advantage. In other words, if people go into public life, public service, whatever you want to call it, or politics, for seeing their face on television, write them off. Now, campaigns are different. You got to do it. But it's awful, isn't it? All this endless money in politics, it's awful. I'm not running again. I'm so glad I'm not running again. For that reason, I'm going to desperately miss the policy. But I, you know, the whole political thing has been turned into a food fight and who can stamp on who. And I don't respect that. I don't participate in that. And I think that's one reason. I think West Virginians understand that.
After decades in Washington, Koppel wanted to know how Rockefeller feels about the current state of politics at the Capitol.
As they look at Washington today,
It's a partisan jungle. The level of nastiness exceeds anything I've seen in 50 years as a journalist. Talk a little bit about what's happened to this country over the last, pick a time period, 20 years? Why are things so ugly today?
I have to be a little political when I say this, but it wasn't ugly 15 years ago. I think the Tea Party had something to do with it. The liberals became so liberal, conservatives became so conservative that there wasn't really any talking with them. And nobody would compromise. Compromise was considered and is considered a dirty word. What is my reaction to that? Very bland. I go ahead and I do my work.
Rockefeller says over the years he's had great success on reaching compromises with members of both parties. But those people he saw not just as allies, but as friends, are beginning to disappear, like former Senator Olympia Snowe from Maine. After the forum, Rockefeller said he's looking forward to not retiring. Instead, he sees stepping away from political office as a chance to commit more of his time to the issues he loves, like technology, education, and national security. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Buchanan.
This is West Virginia Morning. It's 7:44. A freeze warning in effect until 10 o'clock this morning for north-central portions of the state. Temperatures will be reaching the 60s and 70s today under partly sunny skies. Lows tonight will be in the 40s and 50s. Rain likely on Friday, temperatures remaining in the 60s and 70s. Partly cloudy on Saturday with a chance of rain in the north, sunshine on Sunday.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by West Virginia Division of Rehabilitation Services, enabling and empowering workers with disabilities to meet business workforce needs. Visit wvdrs.org for employer services.
The Appalachian Institute of Digital Evidence is holding its fifth annual conference this week in Huntington and in Charleston. Clark Davis has the story on the ever-evolving world of digital evidence.
John Sammons is an integrated science professor at Marshall. He's also the founder and president of the Appalachian Institute of Digital Evidence. The four-day event took place Monday and Tuesday in Huntington at the Marshall University Forensic Science Center and concludes with sessions today and tomorrow in Charleston at the Capitol Conference Center. Salmon says this is such an important event because in the 5 years the conference has been held, things have changed dramatically in the field.
It's changing constantly, and that's one of the challenges of working in this field is things change all the time. And some changes are subtle. Let's say you have a version of a software from one version to the next. Others are more radical as far as, let's say, all the NSA things that have just come to light. Those kind of things cause some sweeping issues across both disciplines and legally.
This year's conference is touching on everything from how first responders should treat digital evidence, the use of social media and gathering evidence, and the use of mobile phones as digital evidence. David Abrazino is director of the Open Source Intelligence Exchange at Fairmont State University. He says once anything is posted online, it's open to the public and investigators.
We're really dealing with a period in history where, for the first time, universal knowledge sharing is possible. I can take everything I know about a subject, I can put it in a blog, I can send it out as tweets, I can post it to Facebook, and everyone else on the planet who has access to the internet can know what I know about that subject. And if we can figure out how to leverage that access and leverage that information, it's certainly going to improve things for all parties concerned.
Abrazino and a group of his students gave presentations this week on mining and finding information from open source sites.
Open source in the context within the way we use it refers to any information that can be gathered through unclassified or non-secretive means. So it's information that is publicly available. It may be hard to find, but there's no one actively trying to prevent you from obtaining it.
Among those sites are social media sites, which are heavily used in today's world. Abrazino says if law enforcement can learn the techniques, they stay ahead of the game.
The technology is always changing, but the tradecraft isn't. So in terms of the tools we use, those may change day to day, but the basic skills that you need to successfully leverage that information, that doesn't change.
Salmon says many would be surprised the role that social media has played in past investigations in the region. Salmon says most do not realize how easy it is to obtain information.
I think by and large, most folks would be totally shocked at what's publicly available or what could be available for a small amount of money. There is a phenomenal amount of information on consumers that are tracked, you know, without their knowledge. And then from an investigative standpoint, there's a tremendous amount of information to be mined as far as from a public safety perspective.
The conference concludes tomorrow at the Capitol Conference Center in Charleston. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. We're interested in your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Follow us on Twitter at WV Public News and find us on Facebook. Our producer is Beneduccio. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.